Welcome, listeners and viewers. This is Ron Stefanski from Disrupt Ed, where we talk to the seemingly ordinary people who are making an extraordinary impact. And for 2024, as our disrupted community has exploded, we decided we had a simple theme and vision for this year, and it's next level. So everything you're going to see out of the disrupted community is going to be next level, and I'm going to start with the fact that we have a new format, ordinary humans making an extraordinary impact, and we have a new guest host who I'm going to introduce here. She is phenomenal, and she's going to bring so much to this series. Ashley Williams joins us. She's the CEO of Rezar, and I'm going to let her tell her story a little bit before we get into it with our first ever guest on Ordinary Humans Making an Extraordinary Impact. So welcome, Ashley. Tell us your story. Tell us why I'm so excited having you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Ron, for having me today. And I'm going to be really probably humble with my story a little bit so we can get right to Chris. But I was a journalist for a number of years. I worked at NBC News, a station in Baltimore, WBAL, and also USA Today. And then I recently started my company called Rezar, and really excited to participate here on the conversation.
Fantastic. Now, for those of you who have been following us since the very beginning, one of our first guests was the man with the meteoric rise in Detroit. He began at Eastern Michigan as an undergrad, studied design, studied the customer experience, and then landed at the doorstep of Dan Gilbert, where history happened for him. Chris Coffin, welcome to Disrupt Ed. It's so great to have you back.
So great to be back. Thanks for having me. Ashley, great to meet you.
You too, Chris.
And I think we have our act together a little bit more than we did the last time, Chris. You were one of our very first guests. So I think we figured this format out. And so Ashley and I are just going to jump in here and fire some questions off. So I know a little bit about your start from your days with Dan Gilbert. So you literally walked into an office one day where Dan stopped by and handed you something he'd scratched out on a sheet of paper and said, "Why don't you go build me this right?" So tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's a few parts to that because, you know, my first interaction with Dan was back in 2006. And, you know, I was finishing up my degree at Eastern. I was interning at Quicken Loans during my last semester there. And you know, got to know Dan. You know, it was a much smaller organization at the time. You know, the iPhone didn't even exist yet. So, you know, the digital experience, especially around mortgages and especially around financial services content, was very much in its infancy, but it was something that Dan was super interested in. And it really, you know, gave me an opportunity to work closely with him on a few projects because, you know, there really wasn't a lot of people doing what I was doing. And, you know, I was, you know, within those walls, one of the few, maybe the only person who was doing, you know, UI UX design at the time. And, you know, he had taken an interest in that and, you know, it was a passion of mine, and it was something we really connected on. And, you know, fast forward, started a company kind of within marketing there called Quizzle. We spun that out. And then I started another company called Up2 that Dan invested in. And, you know, we were in the process of getting acquired by Yahoo, and you know, Dan basically talked us out of it and convinced us to stay in Detroit and start what became StockX, which was a very vague and rough idea that he had around applying stock market mechanics to secondary retail. But that's really where it all started, and you know, from there we really kind of figured out that sneakers were going to be our core product, and started researching that market, researching how stock markets work, and you know, really kind of pulled the two worlds together, you know, in a way that has been you know, really incredible to see. And, you know, obviously the platform has grown significantly over the years, and it's just, it's such a passionate community of people. You know, it was a lot of fun to be a part of.
Great. Actually, I'm going to let you jump in here now.
Yeah, Chris. So during those earlier, that's such a great story. And it's really just interesting, just all the intricate details that you described there. But as you were looking at your earlier days with starting, getting the company going, and Dan really convincing you to focus on this idea, how did you approach it, especially for a lot of entrepreneurs who are first, you know, getting going on their venture enterprise? What were some key things that you think really helped you all to put in a solid foundation for your success, or hopeful?
Yeah, you know, I think, intentional success. You know, and from our perspective, we weren't super passionate about sneakers specifically. We were passionate about solving a problem. And, you know, I think that needs to be the number one driver for any entrepreneur who's, you know, going to find success. And, you know, I think the thing is, even if you do have a really good idea and you are solving a problem, it doesn't mean you're going to be successful. But I think it's one of the things that is absolutely critical, you know, in creating a successful business, is like, you need to be disruptive in some way. And, you know, that often means solving a problem for people. And, you know, that was our focus. And, you know, in the beginning, we didn't know a lot about sneakers. So, you know, we really embedded ourselves in that community. We really wanted to be able to do this authentically and, you know, really understand what was motivating people and why this was special to people. You know, from a brand perspective, that was incredibly important to us. And then from a product, experience perspective, we really wanted to figure out, what are the challenges that people are facing? You know, why does the current, you know, system or current market not work for people? And, you know, what we found was, thinking about the mechanics of a stock market, we're actually going to solve a lot of the problems that people were experiencing. And, you know, the three tenets of a stock market are authenticity, anonymity, and transparency. And, you know, what that means is, if you're buying a share of stock, you have no doubt that it's authentic. You have no idea who you're buying it from. And you know exactly what the last person paid for it. And, you know, applying those same mechanics to secondary retail, specifically the sneaker market to start, gave people that type of, you know, counterfeit goods were a big problem at the time, and this is, you know, nearly a decade ago at this point. That has improved significantly with our platform. And then, you know, really for sellers having to deal with things like eBay and, you know, like, they're handling the customer service, they're handling shipping, you know, any kind of issues, like, for us to come in and kind of eliminate that and take that off their plate, I think was huge. And then for consumers, price transparency, you know, was critical to really democratizing that market, because there was so much price disparity all over the place, because there was no knowledge there around what's something actually worth. And there were things that, you know, were selling for hundreds of dollars over what the market value should have been, just because people didn't have that transparency. And that was a huge goal of ours to solve for.
Chris, when you were putting this all together, you were largely responsible for the customer experience. So tell us a little bit about what prepared you in your work with Quicken prior to that, but also in your own academic background at Eastern. What prepared you to start thinking really meaningfully? Because you're basically inventing a marketplace. You're inventing a product that doesn't exist. So you have no sort of benchmarks to follow. This is all open, you know, open sky in front of you, correct?
For the most part, yeah. But, you know, design is a problem-solving discipline. And, you know, I think even going back to undergrad, going through a design program, you know, something you learn very early is yes, design is about creating beautiful things and making things aesthetically pleasing, but, you know, there is a massive function component to it as well, which is, you know, the biggest part of design is figuring out how things should work and why they should work a certain way. And there are multiple ways that that come into play. You know, one, research is extremely important. You know, really talking to people and seeing what problems that they're experiencing and, you know, better ways to solve those problems. And then once you actually do build an interface, right, like you've got a hypothesis around this will solve the problems that, you know, people are experiencing. And, you know, this is based, you know, hopefully on some kind of research or, you know, hearing friction, you know, hearing about friction that people are running into. You need to continue to test. You need to continue to have those conversations. It's, you know, it's not just like you build something and you put it out in the world and it's perfect. This is an iterative process forever. And, you know, sometimes you get closer in the beginning than other times. And, you know, I think StockX in the beginning, we're kind of middle of the road, which is where most people kind of net out. And, you know, you realize there are some things you're solving for. There are some things that make sense to you that the second you get them in front of your customers make no sense at all. They're confused. And, you know, ultimately you want to continue to refine that process, the UI, the UX, over time, as you learn, as markets change, as human behavior changes, because all of this is constantly in a state of flux. And, you know, I think design specifically is something where I think a lot of people have this idea that you design something and you put it out in the world and it's done. And, you know, from a product perspective, from a marketing perspective, none of that could be farther from the truth. This is an iterative process that never ever ends.
Right. You know, actually, I think this would be a great time for you to jump in here, because I'd be curious to hear you weigh in on your perspective as a serial entrepreneur as well. You started your career as a journalist and then decided to move into the content side of journalism and sort of expand beyond that with Rezar. So as Chris has been talking about this from a design perspective, how much of that resonates with your own story of starting a company?
Yeah, as he was talking, and as you were saying that, Chris, words I wanted to say were, yeah, farther from the truth too, as well. And then you ended up saying that phrase. So I was like, yep, right away. But I agree with him, because especially the world is constantly changing. What people are consuming is constantly changing. So it's a process of really being integrated with what's happening around the world, as well as and I know Chris would say that probably too, what's happening in the world and what's happening with the customer or the person that you're interacting with, like on a daily, even minute by minute basis, I would say. And I think from the standpoint of even content, just how people consume content has changed significantly from when I was even at USA Today, and that was like my last official journalism role in the world, towards working on Rezar. And we were working on shareable content at the time, and just seeing how shareable content has even changed over time within that, like within the last like 10 years or so, that was 2014. So much has changed. And I think that the key to it all, as Chris was saying, is really to stay focused on learning and also just connecting with the person or the customer that you're trying to reach, knowing that it is constantly changing. And anyone who thinks that they can just pause and be like, okay, I'm done, that's like, no. And even at Rezar, like we're working on the next version, we're calling it Rezar 2.0, but essentially redeveloping that platform as well, and continuously finding ways to help our creator and the brands that we're working with.
And Chris, you have been a serial entrepreneur. So you mentioned Quizzle, you mentioned other ventures before StockX, and not every venture is going to be a unicorn, but in point of fact, that's what StockX has gone on to do. And I think its current valuation is over $3 billion now, over less than a decade. So what do you think, you know, in your mind, as you look at some of the other ventures you've been involved in, what was the mark of differentiation? How did StockX take on this life of its own and just become this bursting, fast growing unicorn?
So I think there is a major component to this that, you know, we were kind of just talking about design being an iterative process, and, you know, your product, no matter what it is, being iterative. And that is because the market is always changing, consumer behavior is always changing, the way people communicate is always changing. And some of this is really just about all of the right things aligning at once. You know, previous startups that I've worked on, it's not like they were bad products. It's not like they had bad teams. People were putting just as much blood, sweat, and tears into those ventures as we did with StockX. So much of this comes down to, obviously, you need a good idea. You got to put the hard work in, but you got to be in the right place at the right time. Like, you got to have the right consumers who are ready for your product. You got to have the right market. And with StockX, the stars aligned because we had a good product, we had a passionate team, and we certainly had no problem putting the work in. And at the same time, we had a customer base that was hungry to do things differently. They were, ready for the market to be disrupted. They were ready for a platform that, was going to change the way this market operated. And, we were able to ride a rising tide where, we were growing significantly at the same time the sneaker market was growing significantly. So, not only do we get to experience the growth of the business, but more importantly, we get to experience the growth of the market. And, when you look at other businesses that have reached, quote unquote, unicorn status, it's almost universally the same situation where they're experiencing meteoric growth as a brand, but the market they're in is also exploding at the same time. And it almost exclusively requires, those elements happening concurrently, to have that kind of explosive growth. Having 100% or more year-over-year growth outside of that kind of perfect storm is pretty much unheard of.
Right. Now, you've gone on, when we were talking a year or so ago, you had just decided to take a break, that StockX had reached that point of being a mature business where your interest as a serial entrepreneur was fading, that you love the chaos and the hunt and the start for something new. So you stepped away to go back to graduate school, and you didn't just take on one program. You decided to go to Cranbrook to get your degree in design and then get an MBA from Northwestern, two very, very powerhouse schools. So you got super committed at that, and then you kept going, and now you're back in another startup, Art Club. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's shaping your latest venture.
Yeah, Northwestern's actually learning and organizational change. So it's kind of, the people side of business, which is, another passion area for me. But Art Club is, really the intersection of two amazing things and, two things that have been a focus of my career, marketplaces and art, and, being able to, work with some incredible partners on this and, merge those two passions and, hopefully solve some, problems that are, you know, have emerged in the art world over the past few decades, you know, really solve some frustrations for artists, you know, not completely dissimilar from, you know, some of the things that, you know, people in the sneaker community were experiencing a decade ago, where there's a need for democratization. And, you know, with Art Club, it's far more about building the community up front, where, you know, StockX, we jumped right into the platform, you know, viewing this a little bit differently around, you know, let's really talk to artists and collectors and get a sense for the challenges that they are experiencing. And, you know, the art world is very top heavy. It, you know, it's almost a microcosm that mirrors the broader economy. But there is a small group of people that typically control value and, you know, what they say is cool and trendy and worth owning. And, you know, what happens in this process is a lot of emerging artists get left behind. So, you know, we're really focused on creating a platform for emerging artists, for collectors that want to collect their work. And as a part of that process, giving artists an opportunity to earn residuals on their work. You know, when you look at almost any creative profession, writers, actors, every single time that work is bought and sold, the people involved are receiving some kind of royalty or residual on that work. Visual artists are the only ones who are not included in that. So if they sell a painting for $1,000, typically a gallery is going to take between 40 and 50% of that. If that collector who bought the work turns around and sells that piece of work for $20,000 a few years from now, the collector is the one who exclusively profits on that work. There's no opportunity for the artist to earn any additional income on that work as soon as it's out of their hands. So, you know, we're trying to democratize things that way. We're, you know, leaning heavily on tech to, one, authenticate work, and two, to create a chain of ownership, which is extremely important. And, you know, on one hand, really empower artists and give them, you know, more economic opportunity, but also to provide a service for collectors to catalog work, to discover and buy work from emerging artists that, you know, hopefully has great investment potential. And then, you know, also helping them value their work over time, which, you know, can have, you know, ramifications for taxes and insurance and, you know, all these things. And, but not, you know, not leaving the art world to the ultra wealthy, you know, opening up access to more people, because it is attainable. I think people just need the tools to, you know, be able to get that access, which is, you know, really the focus of what we're doing.
Right. It seems to me that from a consumer point of view, you're really looking to understand, you know, who are those that are investment worthy. I want to invest. I want to collect. But, you know, when I started buying art, for example, on a small scale as an individual collector, nothing, you know, super significant, I looked for quality artists that were, you know, that I also loved, that I would also love to display. And how those artists get represented in the marketplace, some of them may just end up being, you know, community treasures and people who are artists who are understood in their communities, and others have, you know, lightning rod impact on the market. So how do you as an art club help shape that or help influence that toward the benefit of the artist and toward the benefit of the community collecting them?
So, I mean, it's like any business that I think is thoughtfully created, and it's involving the people that you're going to impact in the process. And it's focusing on solving the problem more than driving revenue. And yeah, you know, kind of going back to our conversation about Dan, you know, one of his, you know, what he calls isms are numbers and money follow, they don't lead. And, you know, I think that is true in any business where you are solving human-centric problems. And this one is no different. We're keeping our focus on solving the problem, not how much money we're going to make or how much, you know, revenue we're going to drive. You know, we've got that modeled out. We, you know, we're confident that we have a solid business model that, you know, we'll be able to be sustaining. But the more important thing is focusing on that problem first, because everything follows that. And, you know, part of that solving that problem authentically is having authentic conversation with artists about the challenges they're facing, and, you know, making sure you're solving a problem that is going to be beneficial to the people that are experiencing it. Because if not, you're just not going to get traction. You're not going to get people to use the platform.
Right. That makes sense. Ashley, any last minute questions or thoughts as we wrap this episode with Chris?
Chris, you know, if you could go back in time and maybe give yourself like a piece of advice that you wish someone would have given you as you were starting your entrepreneurial journey, are there any thoughts that come to mind that you wish you would have heard more that you now know?
I think the biggest one is, you know, we all have 24 hours in the day. You just have to be very careful about how you budget them. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, one of the hardest lessons you learn over time is that more time spent on something does not necessarily mean a better product. It doesn't mean you're going to get to market faster. Self-care and sleep and, you know, taking care of your health, like all of these things matter. And, you know, quality of time spent on something is far more important than quantity of time. But that takes a really long time to figure out. And, you know, it takes, you know, probably some unnecessary sacrifice on the part of many entrepreneurs to get to that point.
Ashley, you want to share your really closing thoughts?
Yeah, I just think you are an incredible human being, Chris, and it was so great having you on the show. And thank you for all of your contributions to our world and the impact that you're making and that you continue to make on so many lives. And I'm really inspired by your journey, and I'm sure the audience, as they hear more about it, will continue to be as well. So thank you so much.
Well, I've thought Chris has been an incredible human for a long time, and I really enjoyed meeting him at a Connect Up in Detroit. I think what's really exciting about this first episode is that we're showcasing two entrepreneurs in our own community here in Detroit. And that's exciting because we have a very vibrant tech entrepreneurial community that's rising. We have the Center of Mobility rising at the Michigan Central that's drawing a whole lot of entrepreneurial activity to the city. So I think it's very exciting. And Chris, I knew a year ago that when you said you were going to take a little time to level off, that was not even close to being a real statement or an authentic statement, that you didn't lay off the accelerator at all. But it's exciting to see this new venture. So we're going to be following you, and we're going to be inviting you back. In the meantime, Ashley, it's great to have you on this show to bring your perspective as a budding entrepreneur, as a rising entrepreneur as well. So for those of you listening, this is our first episode. Let us hear from you. We're going to be featuring a whole lot of seemingly ordinary people who are making an extraordinary human impact in this ginormously disrupted world. They are the ultimate disruptors. And so give us your feedback, join our community, and stay tuned for another episode of Disrupt It. Thanks so much.